concerns that he expressed. This bill really does two things. It allows all OLCC licensees to
make their licenses are available, then it doesn't matter anymore because the pressure's off. But it's surprising to me that this took place at this time, and I don't know what's ahead, what's coming down ahead in the months for the legislature, but that's just something to think about.
Another liquor-related bill that will be before the Senate Judiciary Committee next week on Thursday, February 1st, Senate Bill 12. This bill repeals Oregon's so-called dram shop statute, which would make bar and tavern owners and private hosts liable for all damages resulting from serving alcohol to an intoxicated person, and it would substitute a new standard for finding liability. The new language in this bill, Senate Bill 12, provides that a bar or tavern owner or private host shall not be liable to either an intoxicated person or to any third party for injuries caused by the intoxicated person unless the owner or the host has been grossly negligent in serving alcohol to the intoxicated person. Gross negligence is defined in the bill as a, quote, conscience indifference to or reckless disregard of the rights of others. That's Senate Bill 12. Will be heard next Thursday, February 1st at 1 p.m. in Hearing Room A of the State Capitol. The Senate Judiciary Committee will hear that bill. If you'd like to come down and listen to the testimony or provide some of your own, you are cordially invited. That's next Thursday at 1 o'clock, Hearing Room A here in the Capitol. Senate Judiciary Committee, Senate Bill 12. Lots of activity going on this morning. A news conference. Four statewide organizations at a news conference this morning voiced their concerns over the future of energy for the state of Oregon. Speaking out were representatives from the League of Women Voters of Oregon, Oregon Common Cause, the Oregon Environmental Council, and the Oregon Division of the Isaac Walton League. Michael Farley, executive director of Oregon Common Cause, opened the news conference and he talked about energy need forecasting and siting of new power plants.
The three statewide organizations represented here today are disturbed about recent suggestions by Governor Attia and new energy director Kelly Woods for legislation that would erode the ability of the Oregon State Energy Department to provide comprehensive state leadership on energy planning and independent forecasting. The citizens of Oregon will pay increasingly higher electric rates for each additional coal and nuclear plant which is constructed in our area, since electricity from these sources is 15 times more expensive than power generated from federal dams. Therefore, it is essential that the public participate in decisions on whether to build these plants and have access to independent information about the needs for additional energy. The independent energy forecast produced by the Oregon Department of Energy annually is an essential ingredient to sound planning based on the public interest. Also important is maintenance of an energy facility siting council composed of members of the public who will decide on the basis of a full record of information whether
letter of invitation. If anything else, that gives you an idea how things have changed. The Cadandran is coming. They will be here. I think, again, it's not a matter of just of influencing and talking to Japanese, but also the word spreads in terms of what kind of a state Oregon is. And I think we're getting some very good reports from the companies that are here. Let me back up a minute. The Department of Commerce deals with about 140 different kinds of licenses. And let me show you what they've done. They took all the licenses and they put them up on the wall and said, now look, I didn't tell them to do this. They did this on their own initiative. And they began to look at what was there. And they began to think in terms of consolidation. And now they have a consolidated form. That's it. And I would tell you about a third of this, that is language and things that are required, are by statute. Some of which really don't make any sense, but the Oregon law. A third of this is by statute. And what did it replace? This. Now, you didn't tell me to do this. I didn't have a Grace Commission. I didn't have any of these great studies that went on. I just said, look, we got to make common sense in state government. I know I should operate. This is what they did. I maybe get a little testy about it. You know, some people say we haven't been planning for Oregon's future. We have. The only thing that we haven't done is have the typical study committee, the blue ribbon, whatever you want to call it. You know and I know, if you were to take the job, what should be done in state government? I knew. And I went out there and began to do this kind of a job for you and for all Oregonians. This is only one example. Only one example. But I want you to feel proud of what's going on. Lumber, wood products, and agriculture are major industries, and they always will be our keystone because we're a natural resource state. We can grow trees. We've got good agricultural land. We've had a tough fight with lumber and wood products. Of course, a lot of it happened because of that high interest rate and this cooling down the economy, if you will, and we really got pneumonia in the worst way. At the same time, the operators of these sawmills had been out there and they were needed the timber because it was closing up on these various wilderness studies that are going on, and they overbid, and they got stuck, and they were in real danger of going broke and bankrupt. Well, the first step was ours, the state of Oregon, in 1982, in January session, cutting back the budget. And I went to the legislatures and I said, I want us to be able to rebid our Oregon timber. And they passed the bill, and we did, and we saved about 2,000 jobs. But Oregon state-owned timberland is very small. BLM, the Forest Service, is the largest. And then the fight came, particularly in this administration of mine, that's the Reagan administration, what a fight it was, to try to get relief from the federal government in terms of timber contracts. I would say to you that Mark Hatfield certainly gets a large measure of credit for getting that bill passed. It was a tough one to pass. I would take some credit for preventing the president from vetoing the bill, because he was seriously thinking about vetoing the bill. We talked to some of his advisors and we talked directly to the president, and he did not veto the bill. There's much more to be done. I would tell you the next big thing coming up in terms of Forest Service is the new forest management under the U.S. Forest Service, and we have some fears they're going to substantially cut back the amount of allowable cut in Oregon. I asked for, and the legislature agreed to give me some money so that we could professionally study and professionally reply to the Forest Service in regard to their plan that might come up, and we are in preparation of making just exactly that kind of a comment to them. We cannot stand, again, a reduction in the allowable timber, which allows enormous pressure on the sawmills that need wood to do business. Well, commitment to Oregon for economic development, change the image of Oregon, dedicate this administration to human resource, and what this really means is jobs for those Oregonians out there, return our government to common sense, remove our strangulation, diversify our economy, challenge nonsense legislation. Let me just close with that and answer your questions. I don't know if any other governor has vetoed as many bills as I have. I can certainly tell you that I have what's called a modern day record. I vetoed 40 bills out of one session in the Oregon legislature. We discovered Oz West vetoed 70 bills. He was a cantankerous governor. I think I'm cantankerous. I don't think, you know, someday somebody might, and I doubt ever will, match his 70 veto record. I don't think so, but they'll never match his percentage, because that 70 represented a third of the bills passed by the legislature. But I did. I vetoed 40 bills. I think I came here and told you about that, and I went back and reported and said, what'd they say? I said, they said only 40. I told Labor, this is 1983, told them early on, they came in for increased benefits, as they usually do, and under workers' compensation, and I said, look, I have no problem with the benefits going up. Matter of fact, I think that they should go up. But I will veto any bill that comes and asks for an increase in benefits without a commensurate reduction in the cost of workers' comp. I told them that early on. I told it to them in my office, their lobbyists. I went to a labor meeting at lunch, told them all the same. I wasn't shy about it. Well, they apparently didn't believe me. So they just rammed those bills through the legislature, and I vetoed every single one of them. Every single one. If I had not done that, workers' comp rates would have gone up $54 million. As a result of what we had done, Oregon no longer, as that began in 1979, no longer number one in the nation in cost of workers' comp. We did and have saved you $81 million a year. I know that there's some problems that are arising in terms of workers' comp. I only want to assure you this. There's been an increase in the cost of workers' comp. It was not as a result of any legislation that passed the Oregon legislature. That doesn't mean that workers' comp is as good as it can be, because it isn't. We want some changes and couldn't get them through the Oregon legislature. Better definition of stress. Couldn't make that. But they didn't pass anything to add to your cost. There's a lot of things to do with the insurance industry and the losses they were getting, and they have to make up those losses, and I knew it was going to come without any pressure or any changes. Well, I must tell you that the future of Oregon is bright. We still have some things yet we want to do. I will just briefly tell you the kinds of things that are on my agenda, and that is between now and then. I will travel again overseas, probably early sometime first part of this year, going to Hong Kong, China, Shanghai, and Malaysia. I think we ought to begin to break into the ASEAN nations. We've not yet done that. And if it's appropriate for me to go, well, I don't have any plans for it, there are times in which it's important for the governor to go to either Korea or Taiwan or Japan in order to begin to close deals. When they get that close, they'll talk to a governor. I'll go, but there's no plans for that. I will propose very shortly, a proposal in regard to the stability of our schools in the state and controlling the growth of property taxes. My liability insurance task force, which I put together, it's my own, it's not a legislative committee, they just met last week. And I'm asking to give them a deadline of July 1 to give me an answer what we can do. Incidentally, these are people in the insurance business, they're lawyers, they're citizens, I chose them. And I believe that they don't have to study this thing, they know what's out there. And they'll tell us where the insurance companies themselves have caused the problems, where the high court cases have caused the problems, and they'll give me some answers. Certainly we're going to have to work to cushion the impact of Grand Rudman Hollings. We'll do what we can, but I am along that line of balancing the budget, and I believe that we need to remind ourselves why this is all going on. And let me just share with you, you probably already know it, the debt, the national debt in the United States today, as we're in this room, is over $1.4 trillion. That's the debt we have right now. And the annual interest that we pay is $137 billion. That's the interest on the debt. Graham Rudman Hollings says you can have a deficit, but it has to be a smaller deficit each of 5 years till you get to zero. Now, if they follow Graham Rudman Hollings, and I'm not sure Congress will have the courage to do it, if they follow it, in 1991 we will have a $2 trillion deficit. So it's important that any responsible person work to do what we can, but we still have to run our government. I have a port study. We all know, and certainly some of you, and you know, that ports always fought among each other. We got them together, and I said, what can we, the state, do to make sure that all of our ports have an opportunity, because it's a selling tool for us? Rail abandonment is going all over the state. Rather than do it piecemeal, as communities come to us, I've got a task force looking at rail abandonment so we can approach this in a comprehensive way. Those are only among the things, the travel, the tax pay proposal, liability task force, the port study, Wonder River Gorge legislation I want very badly. And then finally to institutionalize those kinds of things that have been going on during this administration. That means this kind of thinking that I just demonstrated to you right here, and all the other things I believe are important and should remain after I leave office. Thank you very much for the opportunity of letting me be governor of Oregon. I have to tell you, although I'll be very frank, I get some very mixed reactions about what's called the business community up here, and I'm not sure who that is, but the business community say, well, you know, he hasn't done a very good job, he's do nothing. I don't believe it. I feel confident in my own self, my own conscience, that I have done the job you want done. And as a matter of fact, I honestly believe, I know this is terribly self-serving, that under the circumstances, that means the economic circumstances the state of Oregon have gone through, and the fact that I need also to do not continue to have a balanced budget and run my state government. Under those circumstances, I think that this administration has done a very good job. I was going to be a little more effusive about it, but I won't. I really think so. In my own heart, I feel good about what's happened. We're going through the campaign. It makes my wife irritated when she reads about some of the things that are being said. And yet I have to deal with it in my own mind. I have to deal with it. And I understand the governor's campaign, those who are running for governor, will take what's here and do better. And that's okay. It's fine. It's good for you and for me. I'm an Oregon citizen. I plan to stay here and be here. But I do feel that everything that's happened is the kind of thing you really wanted to happen. You did. The unfortunate thing is you really didn't know all about it, in the typical PR sense. And I will close with something that I talked about starting in 1974. And I have said it publicly time and time again, and I believe I've delivered. But I believe that substance is by far more important than style. And it's the bottom line that you want. That is the substance and performance of what needs to be done. And maybe I put it in a more theatrical way when somebody was asking me about leadership, and I said, look, I was elected to run the biggest business in the state. I was not elected as an entertainer. Thank you very much, and let me answer any questions that you have. I think she would be perceptive. A lot depends on what the Oregon legislature would allow it to happen. Yes, I would. I have thought in my mind that I would make the offer to the winner that very early in the administration that I would go with the new governor and introduce that new governor to the friends that I made and tell them about that new governor so that we can run that string in continuity. That new governor can take off almost where I left off. They have to get to know that new governor before that finally happens, but an introduction by me, I think, would be extremely helpful. And incidentally, you can't help. I'm not really self-conscious. I've heard about these Trader Vic and all the rest. I've heard it. But I know it's good for Oregon, and I'm willing to take the heat for it. I really am. And particularly, as I say, in the light of the fact, when you look at it, an average of 2 weeks a year is really not an awful lot of travel as far as that's concerned and productive results. But you can help. You can help, because what you need to do is get political courage to that new governor. If that new governor believes it's a political liability to make the trips, she won't. Yes, Dave. Yes.
However, this is her question. We think that you've done a great job. Are you retiring from politics forever? Now my question is specific. Mark is coming to before you know. Would you consider running for the U.S. president?
Dave, thank you for asking, because I can make it very clear that when I finish my term as governor, I'll have served in public elective office 28 years. I would also say to you that it's not the most productive way to make a living. And I believe that it's time for me, both physically and mentally, and in terms of what I think I should do for my family, to leave public elective office, and I will. I will not run ever again for a public elective office. I do expect, because of my deep, abiding, concern and interest in my country and my state. But you'll find me involved with issues from time to time, or maybe candidates from time to time. But in terms of me running for anything, that time has passed, and I just will not run again. Yes, Jim.
Governor, you've made two judicial appointments in the first of the year. Comment on those two individuals and bring the club up to date on those.
Jim, I'm glad you asked. this is sort of a rigged here. Actually, Jim is right in suggesting I mention it, and I'm glad you asked the question to make sure that I would. Yes, I've appointed Mick Gillette on the Supreme Court, and he's going to have to run in the primary. Very short time frame. Mick is pretty strong. I doubt very much if anybody's going to run against him, but you never know. I would tell you that he is considered, well, not by myself alone because I picked him, but by those in the profession, is probably one of the more outstanding selections that I've made by those who were available. I think he's very good and certainly on a par with the other choices I made. The second is Mary Dietz. She probably needs more of your knowledge and attention and memory than any of Mick Gillette and Mary Dietz. And she replaced Mick Gillette on the appeals court. She, incidentally, is an assistant attorney general over in the Dave Frohmeyer shop. I've had occasion to see her work. She's a very quiet person. She's very studious. I selected her, really. It was a very close call for me, particularly on her ability to be very seriously adapted to the job that she has, her general philosophy that I sensed, and her ability to write. And of course, the appeals court is one of the hardest working courts, and they have to write opinions an awful lot. So I would hope that if you are approached by support of either one of those two, let me assure you that I believe them to be very good judges. Mary Dietz in the appeals court and Mick Gillette in the Supreme Court, they both have to run, and they have to do it in the primary. And that's only until May of this year, so it's a short haul. Yes, John?
Would you speak about the lottery?
The lottery is an interesting thing. I think you all know that I did not support the lottery. I don't think that the state should base its economic future or any kind of a future on people gambling, but Oregon has obviously wanted it, and they wanted it very badly, and they voted in big. We got running at great pace. Let me put it in proportion. The lottery is going to collect a lot of money, however not as much as they thought they might collect. But you understand, Oregon's in its first year or first 2 years of the lottery. And so they made a prediction that they were going to raise, they thought, $90 million. It's going to raise more than that, but $90 million to the state for economic development, because it's a percentage cut that we get according to the Constitution. Probably now something closer to $80 million. I have trouble understanding people, particularly the president and Senate, call it a cruel hoax. I don't see what $80 million is cruel. I mean, that's $80 million is better than zero. And it's going effectively for higher education in the state of Oregon. We sent it out and really have saved Lakeview and Tillamook in terms of their rail abandonments. We certainly brought up Miss Sailors and Van Dynes. That, I think, finally clinched the deal down in Eugene. And so we put that lottery money to good use in the creation of jobs. So it's not going to raise as much as they predicted, but it's still going to raise a hell of a lot of money. Yes?
What's the status of the economic development fund loan?
You mean the industrial revenue bonds?
Well, that's right. The money's been put out in the communities to finance new industries.
Well, we put out and been more active in that than any prior administration. I don't know what you mean by the question. It's still there. It's still continuing. We're still using it aggressively. I was talking with someone today, incidentally, that would be an Oregon business that wanted to expand and needed that help. They couldn't get it. They were thinking they may have to go somewhere else. I think we can keep them here and have them expand in the state of Oregon using that same fund. Still a very viable one. There's some new funds there. We've got an umbrella loan fund, and that's designed for small business because they couldn't come in. You need a large sale. And so we were allowed to gather them all and be a lot of small ones and put them in one sale. And that'll help in terms of small business.
The state is loaning money to communities to in turn finance projects in their own community.
Oh, okay, that's community development block grant. That's federal funds. Is that what the one you're asking about?
Well, I don't know where the money comes from.
Okay, that's federal funds, and that's the one I was talking about earlier. And the amount of money that went out, I think, was $34 million to 220 some odd different kinds of projects, $10 million of which was to businesses. That, of course, depends on Graham Rudman. Looks like that's going to get a cut. That's unfortunate, because some of those areas are going to get a cut to produce jobs and also produce, of course, income taxpayers. But that one looks like it's going to get a cut. Yes?
What objectives did you have in mind
Well, I want to start off by, first of all, I know the kind of criticism that board's taken, and I was among them. But I still have to say to you and all of you that these were citizens that stuck their neck out. They didn't have to. They'd been more comfortable at home watching television. And I really want to thank them. I thought it was time, really, to really change the whole face of it. A brand new perspective, a different look. I know there's problems there that haven't been addressed, should have been addressed. I must tell you that I'm very proud of the people that have accepted to do that job. And I just felt that these folks had worked awfully hard. They were highly criticized. I guess, like a governor, you know, you accumulate baggage en route, and let's start with a clean slate. The expression I use in terms of being a governor, that friends may come and friends may go, but enemies accumulate. Yes. Yes, they will, and they have. A lot of it, of course, doesn't necessarily. Well, let me say to you that this ours was the first Middle East governor-led trade mission that anyone ever knew about. Certainly, with my Arabic background, that helped as well. I was just talking with C.H. Chumahill. I didn't get it, but I think that we enhanced the image of Oregon by being there, and they just recently got a contract. Bill Bright, who is generating equipment, is also doing business there, and has gotten some more business since then. Certainly, I can't claim for some of the others, but I think now we're doing quite well, and after I leave, I'll look to that area as a possible area in which I can find business for the state of Oregon, and I think I have a unique advantage. Yes. The major one, I would tell you, is that the list of things I told you earlier were not things that went out and talked about as campaign promises. They were kinds of things I thought ought to happen. The same thing related to my major disappointment. And I'll try to answer this because you want to quit. I can tell that by you standing here, John. That
you have a lot of questions.
Yes. All the time I've been in the legislature, and of course as an observant citizen of my community, it seems to me that society and government was always trying to deal with the effects of something bad occurring. Going to jail, breakup of homes, child abuse, welfare, you know, all the bad things that happen in society. We were constantly repairing the damage. And I said, what I want to do as a governor in my 4 or 8 years was to turn that around and get us more thinking in terms of preventing it from happening in the first instance. It costs us so much less, and there's so much less human tragedy. I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it because, in the way I can describe it best to you, it's very hard to devise a fire prevention program when you're out fighting a forest fire. So there I was fighting this forest fire, that is, balancing our budget, and I really couldn't get to do what I wanted to do. We were talking about it today, I might add, in cabinet meeting, and in with human resources this afternoon. It costs us so much to deal with those on parole, those on probation, those in jail, the kids in Hillcrest or McLaren, the foster homes, the we go into a sheltered workshop.